Welcome to the Eldritch Estate, an establishment dedicated to the bizarre, the dark, and all that is otherworldly. We invite our guests to come and stay a while, to enjoy the haunted hallways, the shrieks of terror and delight, to forget time in our enchantingly disturbing abode. Whether it's for an overnighter or a week-long stay, our hostesses will see to it that you are shocked, horrified, and left morbidly curious about the goings-on here at the estate. Will you take a trip with us? We can't wait for you to see what's in store.
Today we'll be covering the Branch Davidians, including talking about David Koresh and the famous siege of the compound in Waco, Texas. I want to issue a trigger warning here. We're going to be discussing child abuse, sexual abuse, and unfortunately, the sexual abuse of children.
Skip.
Before we continue, I wanted to give you guys a heads up. If you need to skip, go forward about 30 seconds to a minute. In 1991 and 1992, David Koresh was accused of several incidents of physical and sexual abuse involving children.
I mean, didn't he marry a 14-year-old?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay.
He had conducted several arranged marriages with various women of the group. Some of these women were underage. Not even women, but children themselves. Some of these women were also married. Koresh claimed his right to marry all these women by referencing a revelation that he'd claimed to have had. So according to his revelation, he was to procreate with 24 women of the compound, and these 24 children would grow up to become the elders of the Branch Davidians after the new millennium and the second coming of Christ. One of the girls was Michelle Jones, and if that name sounds familiar, it's because she was the younger sister of Koresh's first wife, Rachel Jones.
What the fuck?
Yep. Rachel and Michelle were the daughters of lifelong Branch Davidians members Perry and Mary Bell Jones.
Hate it.
At this point in time, 1992, the Texas Child Protection Services had conducted a 6-month-long investigation and had come up with no evidence of these crimes. Members of the group went to great lengths to conceal Koresh's actions, including a surrogate husband, David Thibodeau, for the marriage of Koresh to Michelle Jones. So he literally pretended to be her husband instead of Koresh?
Oh.
Like, they were just like, hey, David, come here, pretend that you're married to Michelle, even though she's a fucking child, too.
Okay.
Katie's, like, stuck. She can just say, oh, and okay right now.
I hate it.
It's a lot.
Mm-hmm.
There were reports by some members that one of Koresh's children, Cyrus, had
how
been...
How original.
I know, right? There were reports that he had been crying frequently in the night, as babies are wont to do, because they're small and they can't communicate their needs.
I was gonna say, that's how they tell you they need things.
Right.
But okay.
According to the report, Koresh got up and spanked the child severely for several minutes on three different occasions that night.
What a piece of shit.
Yup. Another witness claimed that they had seen a child beaten with a stick.
Eye for an eye, hit him back.
Additionally, as per Koresh's revelation, he would be fathering children with all of these women. So now not only is he raping these women, but more children are being born, and it just compounds the whole thing. Like, are you gonna keep your fucking hands off those kids too? Or like, no. We're just gonna continue this cycle of abuse. You're just creating more victims, you fucker. Just more
children.
How
are these people fertile? What the fuck?
Yeah. And then you have children raising children. Like, these women who are being impregnated and having these kids, they're teenagers, they're babies themselves, and now they're trying to raise babies.
They are children.
Yeah. So, it's just a mess. And then, if we think about it too, there's some of these people in here that aren't related to anyone in the group. Like, Rachel and Michelle, their parents are lifelong Branch Davidians, they've always been in this group, they're a part of it, they basically know nothing else. But some of these people are very young folks who are somebody's baby on the outside. Mm-hmm. Like, if your child ran away to join this cult, so parents on the outside are panicked. They think their child might be inside, and they have no idea what could be happening to them in there.
Yuck.
So naturally, people want to get their kids out, or they want to get in and figure out what the fuck is going on.
They about to tear that shit up with a shotgun.
Stuff is getting intense.
Hairy.
People are getting... I don't know. I can't think of a word.
There's not a word for it, bro. That's why you can't think of one.
People are upset. there is a sense of urgency coming into the air.
Well, yeah, he's beating children.
Now, if you know the story, you also know that we are rapidly approaching the involvement of the ATF. The ATF, or Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, is responsible for the investigation and prevention of federal offenses, including the unlawful use, manufacture, and possession of firearms and explosive, acts of arson and bombings, and illegal trafficking and tax evasion of alcohol and tobacco products. They are a domestic task force, and they are overseen by the U.S. Department of Justice.
These are their stories.
Yeah. Dun, dun. That was a mouthful, for sure. At the most basic level, the ATF gets involved because of reports that they're getting from ex-members of the Branch Davidians and other eyewitnesses who are claiming the use of excessive gunfire and explosions at the compound. They're reporting that there are automatic and semi-automatic weapons being fired, and they're reporting that they have heard explosions, and sometimes in the middle of the night or early in the morning.
I'm pretty sure I watched a cult show on Netflix about this, now that I'm thinking about it.
Probably.
Okay.
Obviously, this becomes a concern for the ATF, and they begin to discuss an investigation and a search warrant. That's all it was at first. A search warrant.
Yep. I did watch something on Netflix. Or Hulu or something.
Like I said, Waco is one of the big ones.
Yeah.
All right, here's another quote from Wikipedia. There was a lot to this, so at a certain point I just had to copy and paste, you guys. I apologize, but
this, it's a lot.
My notes are like 20 fucking pages long right now. On February 27th, 1993, the Waco Tribune Herald began publishing The Sinful Messiah, a series of articles by Mark England and Darlene McCormick, who reported allegations that Koresh had physically abused children in the compound and had committed statutory rape by taking multiple underage brides. Koresh was also said to advocate polygamy for himself and declared himself married to several female residents of the small community. We see this with cult leaders a lot, too, where they're like, rules for me and not for the, or rules for thee and
not for
me.
Do as I say, not as I do.
Yeah, I can take several wives and father several children, but everyone else can't have sex. Like, that's what we saw with the Heaven's Gate.
It's like the MLM where you get further down the chain and there's different rules.
Exactly. The paper claimed that Koresh had announced he was entitled to at least 140 wives and that he was entitled to claim any of the women in the group as his, that he had fathered at least a dozen children, and that some of these mothers became brides as young as 12 or 13 years old.
Fuck.
In addition to allegations of sexual abuse and misconduct, Koresh and his followers were suspected of stockpiling illegal weapons.
Because they were.
Yeah, I mean, we heard about his investigation of Rodin with the body.
Mm-hmm.
In May 1992, Chief Deputy Daniel Weinberg of the McLennan County Sheriff's Department called the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms to notify them that his office had been contacted by a local UPS representative concerned about a report by a local driver. The UPS driver said a package had broken open on delivery to the Branch Davidian residence, revealing firearms, inert grenade casings, and black powder.
Oh!
So, like, they were literally just getting this shit shipped to them, and one of the boxes broke open, and the UPS driver was like, that's not good.
Excuse me, I think I may have committed a crime on accident.
Yeah. He was literally like, I don't want to get in trouble, but...
I don't want to wait for my life to be over.
For my job to be over.
Honestly.
On June 9th, about a month later, the ATF opened an official investigation, classified as sensitive, to look into the Branch Davidians and find out more.
The dance.
I know. It's getting late. I'm talking real fast. I can't speak anymore.
You know what? This is a lot, so it's okay. You could even turn into Samuel L. Jackson and I wouldn't be mad at you.
Motherfucker. They set up surveillance nearby the compound and their cover was, quote, noticeably poor.
Oh.
They claimed to be college students, but they were there all hours of the day, were all in their 30s, and drove nice cars and dressed well.
Oh.
So.
Great cover.
Yeah. The Branch Davidians knew they were being observed, basically. An undercover agent by the name of Robert Rodriguez was able to join the Branch Davidians and gain the confidence of David Koresh.
So maybe they used the other ones as a bad decoy.
Maybe. Koresh later revealed that he knew Rodriguez's identity the whole time, but didn't tell anyone until the day of the first raid.
What the fuck?
So it was like, the player played the player kind of thing. Like, oh yeah, you know, this is Dan or whatever, and he's gonna join us and blah blah blah, and the whole time Koresh knows that he's an ATF agent.
This is like watching a bad mafia movie.
But he waits until the end to reveal it. It is literally like a bad mafia movie.
This is a lot.
Before I continue here, I want to be clear that what happened at the Mount Carmel Center outside Waco was a tragedy. Yeah. Lives were lost on both sides, and I'm going to try and be as neutral as possible while discussing the details. I know a lot of people have strong feelings about both sides of this, but I want to keep the facts at the forefront here.
Okay.
One more trigger warning. This is going to involve the death of many people, including children. This next part will be graphic. Listener discretion advised. Hit that skip button, folks.
Where's my skip button?
You don't get a skip button. You're stuck here.
Okay, go.
Okay. On February 25th, 1993, an affidavit was filed by David Aguilera. The affidavit and subsequent warrant alleged that the Davidians had violated federal law. The ATF obtained search and arrest warrants for Koresh and specific followers on weapons charges, citing the many firearms they had accumulated. The search warrant commanded a search, quote, on or before February 28, 1993, in the daytime between 6 a.m. and 10 p.m. There were also allegations made that a meth lab was being operated at the compound, which they tried to request support for, but were ultimately unable to gain any traction with that claim.
Okay.
From February 25th to 27, the ATF ran training operations to get familiar with the interior of the compound, per their reports from their undercover agent, and to practice routine medical and communications equipment, things. On February 28th, 1993, the ATF moved forward with their investigation. They planned to search the compound under the warrant that had been filed. They then loaded up two trailers of armed agents, pulled by two large pickup trucks, and drove towards the compound at approximately 9:45 a.m.
Okay.
I watched an episode on the History Channel about this, and in it they interviewed three of the men who were there on that day.
Oh, shit.
There was one man in particular, Bill Buford, and he was the ATF agent who was basically in charge of the operation.
Oh.
They basically had two approaches that they had discussed taking. The first was to use the element of surprise to try and take the compound peacefully. They wanted to get the men off guard when they were out at their construction duties when they did not have their firearms on them. So basically every morning they had noticed that the men went out to perform construction and that they did not have their guns on them when they did this. So okay. They thought, let's go out at that time. It's around 10 a.m.
Ambush them when they're not armed. Yeah, so it's as safe
they'll be
as possible.
Out of the building. Yeah, that was their plan. Their second approach was a full frontal assault.
Oh!
Now, according to the documentary episode, they had made contact with some ex-members of the Branch Davidians, and they'd been told they will not go quietly. All of these people were armed, and they would rather die defending this place than come out and surrender. It was made very clear to them that negotiation and talking it out wouldn't be completely successful, not without some gunfire and wounded or casualties.
Jesus.
Like, ex-members are saying this. They're saying, like, they're gonna go down shooting.
Fuck.
Despite this, they wanted to go ahead with the element of surprise approach. The only problem being, they lost the element of surprise.
Oh.
The local news station had somehow caught wind of this raid, and they were following the trucks out to the compound to get the story.
And the dead giveaway in every case is, drumroll, the media.
Seriously.
Y'all shit the bed.
So, this place is out in the country, and the news crew becomes lost in the back roads. They make contact with a rural mail carrier who is making deliveries out in the area. They stop to ask for directions.
It's gotta be a weird place in life where you're like, yeah, I was the mail carrier for the Branch Davidians.
Wait for it.
Oh.
The mail carrier says, well, why do you want to go there? And the news crew tells them that there was supposed to be a raid on the compound by federal agents.
That's a bad idea.
Little did they know, this mail carrier was the son of one of the top Branch Davidians, basically the number two guy in the organization.
Done shit the bed.
So, of course, he tips off the leaders of the Davidians, and now they know the fucking raid is coming.
Yeah, he called Pit-Pap and was like, Daddy, they bringing guns.
Mm-hmm.
Damn. Okay.
So, like, shit is fucked.
Yeah.
Right from the beginning. According to the episode, right after they get this call, David Koresh turns to Robert Rodriguez, the undercover agent, and says, they're coming to get me.
Even though he knew who he was.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
It's a little haunting.
Yeah.
Rodriguez then makes some sort of excuse like, hey, I gotta go, you know, vacuum my driveway or whatever.
My Uber's here.
And he leaves the compound. When asked later what the Branch Davidians had been doing when he left, Rodriguez replied, they were praying.
That's Branch Davidian.
What's that?
I said, that's a little eerie.
Yeah.
Okay.
Branch Davidian survivors have written that Koresh ordered selected male followers to begin arming and taking up defensive positions, while the women and children were told to take cover in their rooms.
Winter is coming.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Koresh told them he would try to speak to the agents, and what happened next would depend on the agents' intentions. The ATF arrived at approximately 9:45 a.m. in a convoy of civilian vehicles containing uniformed personnel in SWAT-style tactical gear. So now we have this who-shot-first kind of moment happening.
Not tactical.
Not tactical. The ATF lost the element of surprise. The Davidians knew they were coming, so they start arming and preparing themselves for the raid. Quote, ATF agents stated that they heard shots coming from within the compound, while Branch Davidian survivors claimed that the first shots came from the ATF agents outside. A suggested reason may have been an accidental discharge of a weapon, possibly by an ATF agent, causing the ATF to respond with fire from automatic weapons. Other reports claim the first shots were fired by the ATF dog team sent to kill the dogs in the Branch Davidian kennel. Three helicopters of the Army National Guard were used as an aerial distraction, and all took incoming fire. During the first shots, Koresh was wounded, shot in the hand and the stomach.
Oh.
Within a minute of the raid's start, Branch Davidian Wayne Martin called emergency services, pleading for them to stop shooting. Martin asked for a ceasefire, and audio tapes record him saying, "Here they come again," and, "That's them shooting. That's not us."
Oh, jeez.
Like I said, everything starts to happen very, very quickly at this point. The ATF claim that the Branch Davidians shot first. The Davidians claim that the ATF shot first. Helicopters are flying in and they're being shot at. And it's like a who done it.
Who came first, the chicken or the egg?
Han shot first. Yeah, exactly.
Eesh.
Pointing fingers. It's like that Spider-Man meme.
Yes.
Yeah. Over the next 2 hours, the ATF and the Branch Davidians would engage in a firefight that was likened by several in attendance to a full-scale war.
Jeez.
Hand grenades were thrown.
What the fuck?
ATF agents and Branch Davidians employed the use of fully automatic weapons, and for the first 45 minutes, the gunfire was non-stop.
You know how much money that would be in ammunition nowadays?
Seriously. But, as we discussed, the Davidians had been stockpiling, and...
And it was the 90s, so.
It was the 90s, yeah. The, gun laws and everything were different than what they are now. A news reporter from the local station who had followed the trucks in and was attempting to report from the scene...
No!
...ran back to his news fan to call for help.
Yeah, because there's bullets flying.
He was actually struck by a stray bullet. He didn't take it directly, but it essentially bounced off of a metal door and glanced, like, along his head, I think they said.
Ooh,
or his hand. Yeah. So he ran back to his news van to call for help. Then Sheriff Lieutenant Lynch of the McLennan County Sheriff's Department was the contact point for all of these calls. He states in that History Channel documentary that I was talking about that he could not get a hold of anyone for 45 minutes. But he was fielding calls as they came in. John McLemore of the KWTX news station had been hailed by ATF agents to call and, quote, get every ambulance in the city down here.
Ooh.
He called the news station. And they were asking him, like, well, why? What's going on? He held the phone up, and all the people on the other end could hear were the gunshots and explosions like a battle zone.
Yeek.
They stepped away from the phone for a moment, and when they came back to the phone, they replied, "Every ambulance in this city is already there."
Yike. Zoinks, Scoobs, that's not good.
Fucking zoinks, yeah. Now, while all of this is going on, there are, of course, casualties on both sides. The ATF agents were attempting to enter the building by using ladders to get up on the roof and gain entry through the roof. The Davidians were shooting not just through windows at them, but also through the walls and through the floors in an attempt to get at them as much as possible. Like, they would shoot through the window, and then when they couldn't see them anymore, they'd keep shooting through the wall, or if they heard them down below them, they'd shoot through the floor.
That's terrifying.
Yeah. And like I said, this is a lot, so if you need to skip, we're kind of towards the end of this section, and I'll give you a warning when we get to the next part that's pretty dark. Several ATF agents were injured, but at this point we have our first casualty. In total, 4 agents lost their lives in the firefight. Their names were Steve Willis, Robert Williams, Todd McKeon, and Conway Charles LeBlue. Many of these men were young agents, only a few years on the force, with new wives and newly started families. Another 16 agents were injured, including Bill Buford, the head of the operation. He stated that he'd been hit several times in the leg, hip, and knee, as well as his upper body. Another agent, Eric Evers, had been hit in the shoulder, and the round had knocked him out.
Well, yeah.
In that documentary that I mentioned, he talks about coming to on the ground and seeing the sand around his head jump from the bullet spray.
Yeah.
The Davidians inside were firing at him, trying to shoot him in the head as he's just coming back to consciousness.
No.
So it takes him a minute to realize he's, like, coming to, you know, everything's loud and hazy, and he sees this sand jumping, and he's like, what's that? And then, you know, as he's coming to more and more, he's like, oh,
shit,
they're trying to shoot me in the head. So he found a half-buried school bus not far from his position and basically crawled to it to take cover.
Okay.
I'll try to include a picture of that because it's literally a school bus that's buried in the ground and you could crawl in through, like, the windshield and sit down underground inside it.
Like a bunker, almost.
Yeah. ATF agent Chuck Hustmeyer later wrote, quote, about 45 minutes into the shootout, the volume of gunfire finally started to slacken. We were running out of ammunition. The Davidians, however, had plenty, end quote. Some folks speculate that the only reason the ATF withdrew was because they were running out of ammo. Now, during all of this, Lieutenant Lynch has been trying to get a hold of anyone to try and negotiate a ceasefire. He had been unsuccessful in getting a hold of anyone with the ATF. Finally, he gets a hold of someone on the Davidian side. He answers the phone and he says, you know, I'm Sheriff Lieutenant Lynch, who am I speaking with? And the voice on the other end replies, this is Koresh, David Koresh. So now he's speaking with the leader of the Branch Davidians. He's racing against the clock. He wants to get this ceasefire as quickly as possible and save as many lives as he can.
Yeah.
During this phone call, Lieutenant Lynch asks Koresh if he's interested in a ceasefire. Koresh then launches into a sermon of sorts, talking about the 7 seals of the Book of Revelations. Lynch stops him and says, listen, I don't want to talk theology right now. No. I want to get this thing stopped. And Koresh starts to get loud with him. He says, theology is life and death. And then basically Lynch fucking hangs up on him. He's like, I'm not getting anywhere with this guy.
Talking to a brick wall.
Yeah. Finally, at about 11:45 a.m., nearly 2 hours after the raid had begun, the ceasefire was negotiated between ATF agents and the Branch Davidians. They struck a deal to allow the ATF to get their injured and dead out. In all, 5 Branch Davidians had been killed. Their names were Winston Blake, Peter Gent, Peter Hipsman, Perry Jones, and Jadine Wendell. According to Wikipedia, 2 of those were killed at the hands of the Branch Davidians after having been wounded.
Whew.
The ATF agents loaded up an ambulance with 14 men, some of whom were injured and at least one man who was already dead. So, like, they're just cramming them in there. Yeah. They had several more injured that they could not fit onto the ambulances. The news reporter offered the use of his van to get the remaining men out. Bill Buford was wrapped in a blanket and near death. Eric Evers had also lost a lot of blood and was in and out of consciousness. He was actually the one that had to be pulled out of the complex by other agents, so he was still inside when the ceasefire was called.
Oh.
Two agents came to get him during the ceasefire. I think they allowed them, like, 45 minutes to get their men out or something like that. And as they were trying to get to him, a couple of Davidians aimed their weapons at him. They froze, and they tried to explain that a ceasefire had been called, and they just wanted to get Eric out and leave. The two men held their fire, and Eric was able to get out with the other men. When he's talking about it in the documentary, he says, like, I thought, this is it. Like, they're gonna shoot us. We're gonna die.
Fuck.
Once at the hospital, it was clear that both men had suffered a near death. Buford was found to have two rounds of ammunition lodged near his heart and lungs, which doctors chose not to remove. He still carries those bullets to this day.
Yeah, I can see it.
Evers was told if it had been another 15 to 30 minutes, he would have died.
Yep.
The round that hit him had actually been a ricochet. It had glanced off his shoulder and entered through his chest cavity, grazing his sternum. It barely missed his heart and lungs.
That is so scary.
The doctor said if it had been a direct hit from that round, he definitely would have died. The entire raid lasted from approximately 9:45 to 11:45 a.m. on Sunday, February 28th, 1993. But that's not where our story ends.
Yeek.
This was only day one of a 51-day standoff with the Branch Davidians and the federal government.
Fuck.
Here's another little tidbit from Wikipedia. Quote, at first, the Davidians had telephone contact with local news media, and Koresh gave phone interviews. The FBI cut Davidian communication to the outside world. For the next 51 days, communication with those inside was by telephone by a group of 25 FBI negotiators.
Yeah, you don't let them have media sensation. Fuck that.
But once again, the media, you know, they ate that shit up, and they were like, here we are with David Koresh, leader of the Branch of the Indians, blah, 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 blah.
Coming at you live from the fucking raid where people are dying.
Only on local KDW, blah, 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 blah.
Yep.
In the first few days, the FBI believed they had made a breakthrough when they negotiated with Koresh an agreement that the Branch Davidians would peacefully leave the compound in return for a message recorded by Koresh being broadcast on national radio. That was the deal.
Okay.
The broadcast was made, but Koresh then told negotiators that God had told him to remain in the building and wait.
Okay.
Despite this, soon afterwards, negotiators managed to facilitate the release of 19 children, ranging in age from 5 months to 12 years old, without their parents. However, 98 people remained in the building. The children were then interviewed by the FBI and Texas Rangers, some for hours at a time. Allegedly, the children had been physically and sexually abused long before the standoff.
It's fucking terrible.
It is, like... Obviously, you should never abuse anyone, physically or sexually, but you're in a totally different fucking circle of hell if you do that to children.
Yep.
Totally different circle of hell.
Pineapple in the butt, no lube.
Preach.
Pineapple in the butt, no lube. Little Nikki style.
So the biggest part of this standoff is that the Davidians still refuse to leave the compound. The FBI is now involved, given that many people feel the ATF bungled the raid, and this resulted in the deaths of federal agents. So they were like, you done fucked up, we're taking over.
You fucked up, Aaron.
Mm-hmm. They've made contact with Koresh, and he's agreed, sort of, to leave, but with this caveat. He wants to be able to deliver his final message, and initially the FBI agrees. They say, sure, you can deliver your message, just come on out, give us the kids, and hand over the firearms. Because remember, this all started with the allegations of abuse and the stockpiling of firearms.
Yep.
It was just supposed to be a search warrant. Yep. But then, Koresh says God has told him to wait for this message. It can't be rushed. It's not an overnight deal. He has to wait for the revelation to come to him. Wait for the divine message.
I gotta talk to my people before I talk to your people.
Mm-hmm.
Gross.
So now we start to see a split in the FBI task force. There's two factions. One wants to rally for negotiation, and the other one, once again, wants to try and get these people out by force. The negotiators had sent someone in several times and even talked with Koresh and with the residents at the compound and the children and everything. They'd tried to, like, make the connection, build rapport, and to barter for their removal several times. The whole thing, like I said, it was 51 days.
It's a long fucking time. That's 2 months.
Yeah. And this is after that raid where, like, people on both sides died. Koresh... yeah. Koresh had also secured a lawyer during this time who was making regular visits with him and trying to work with him to defend him. A camera had also been sent in, and Koresh recorded himself using the videotape. He introduces himself, his wives, his children, and several of the Davidians gave statements on the video. They made it clear that no one was being held hostage and that everyone was staying inside of their own free will. Which, if, you know, being in a... or if researching other cults has shown us anything, it's that these people are fully committed. They wholeheartedly believe in their leader.
Yep.
And they probably were staying in their of their own free will.
Signed, sealed, delivered.
Yeah. On the side of those who wanted to force them out from the FBI, psychological warfare tactics were starting to be used. For example, sleep deprivation of the inhabitants of the compound through all-night broadcasts of recordings of jet planes, pop music, chanting, and the screams of rabbits being slaughtered.
That gives me such bad anxiety. Have you ever heard a rabbit scream? Because it's awful.
I have, but it was just one time when my bunny got scared. But yeah, all of those, but especially the sound of an animal being killed and you're playing this at full blast in the middle of the night so that they can't sleep.
And like, why are you recording your kids screaming and crying and shit too?
Mm-hmm. So they're using this sleep deprivation tactic, playing all these loud noises. Outside the compound, 9 Bradley fighting vehicles carrying M651CS tear gas grenades and ferret rounds, and 5 M728 combat engineer vehicles obtained from the U.S. Army began patrolling. So, like, big armored combat vehicles. Yeah. 10 of them. No, 14 of them. They were used to destroy perimeter fencing and outbuildings and crush cars belonging to the Branch Davidians. Armed vehicles repeatedly drove over the grave of Branch Davidian Peter Gent despite protests by the Branch Davidians and the negotiators.
Ooh.
So that's why I said I'm going to try and be as factual as I can here, because wrong was done on both sides, in my opinion. Like I said, what happened here was a tragedy, and there's not really any good parts of it, unfortunately. No. 2 of the 3 water storage tanks on the roof of the main building had been damaged during the initial ATF raid. Eventually, the FBI cut all water and power to the compound, forcing those inside to survive on rainwater and stockpiled military rations, like MREs.
Yeek.
So as I said, this has been going on for a couple months now. The initial raid was on February 28th, and throughout all of March and most of April, this is happening. It's all over the news, the media is sensationalizing it, as they always do. Koresh is being touted as a madman, and he maintains that he is the second coming of Christ, and that God has commanded him to remain within the compound.
Because that doesn't make you look any fucking crazier.
Mm-mm.
Yes. They seem like they're going for the martyr angle, like they will stand by their beliefs or die for them. He insists that no one is being held hostage, and that once this is all over, his followers will essentially be born again, welcomed into the kingdom of heaven, what have you.
Wish-washed clean.
Yep. Once again, the whole, like, well, because you're a member of my cult, when we die, we won't actually die, kind of a thing.
We're gonna ride that comet.
Yeah. And again, you can believe whatever you would like to believe.
Absolutely.
I am all for everyone pursuing their own beliefs, and I'm not going to tell you what to think or what to believe. But like I said, this is an extreme view, and this is a cult, right. So the FBI grows increasingly agitated and desperate. By the middle of April, they're discussing using sniper rifles to kill Koresh and a few other key leaders in the group.
Fuck, they're just going to pick him off.
They're concerned, however, that this will trigger a mass suicide within the compound.
Mm-hmm.
Among the ex-members and rescued children, they all said that a mass suicide was never discussed or planned for, but still, the FBI was wary. And of course, other cults have had similar histories and not told their followers. Like, they would literally do, like, everyone drink the Kool-Aid.
Fire drills, essentially.
Yeah. And then, like, oh, that one wasn't poisoned. Just kidding. Ugh. But, like, I'm glad to see you're dedicated, kiddo.
Good on you.
Yep.
Hope you like that grape Flavor-Aid.
Flavor-Aid. I have another quote. Sorry, like I said, there's just so much, and I wanted to try and get it all in as accurately as possible. From Wikipedia. Newly appointed U.S. Attorney General Janet Reno approved recommendations by the FBI hostage rescue team to mount an assault after being told that conditions were deteriorating and that children were being abused inside the compound. Reno made the FBI's case to President Clinton. Reno stated that the FBI hostage rescue team was tired of waiting, that the standoff was costing $1 million per week, and that the Branch Davidians could hold out longer than the CSAL. This was another organization that they were having a standoff with back in 1985. So she was saying, like, they can hold out for longer than those guys did, basically.
Shit's gonna go down, and it's gonna cost a lot of money.
Mm-hmm. She also said that the chances of child sexual abuse and mass suicide were imminent. Clinton later recounted, "Finally, I told her that if she thought it was the right thing to do, she could go ahead."
Okay.
On April 19th, 1993, 51 days after the initial raid by the ATF, a task force from the FBI laid siege to the compound at Mount Carmel. Federal agents were armed with 50 caliber weapons and armored combat engineering vehicles. They had large amounts of CS gas, also known as tear gas. Using a loudspeaker, they announced to the Davidians that this was not an attack. They just needed to come out peacefully and no one would be harmed. Then, they drove the armored vehicles into the compound. Like, literally drove them into the buildings themselves.
Oh, wow.
Began pumping tear gas inside. Their hope was to flush them out.
Yeah.
The report maintains that no shots were fired by FBI agents during this time. The Branch Davidians fired upon the agents, but they report that they did not fire in return. They used explosives to punch holes in the walls of the compound in an effort to pump more gas in. Their plan was to increase the amount of gas over the course of 2 days in an effort to get the Branch Davidians to exit the compound.
That had to be fucking miserable.
Mm-hmm.
Like, for everyone involved.
Mm-hmm. Again, you just get this vision of a war in your head between two factions. Like, this happened on U.S. soil. It's crazy to think about. Every time I was researching this, I would just have to stop and be like, holy shit, this really happened.
Because of a guy who said he was God in 1933.
Mm-hmm. And he had lots of guns, and people said that he was abusing children.
This is a lot.
It's a lot, a lot.
A lot, a lot, a lot.
After approximately 6 hours, none of the Davidians had exited the building.
Damn, that is fucking willpower.
Many of them were underneath the compound in a concrete bunker room, or they were using gas masks to avoid the brunt of the assault.
Mm-hmm.
But still, like, 6 fucking hours. And not just them pumping tear gas in, but also them crashing into the buildings and punching holes in the walls with explosives.
Yeek.
This is the last trigger warning that I'm gonna give. We are nearing the end of this encounter, and it is dark. There will be mention of death, including the death of children. At around noon, 3 fires broke out almost simultaneously in different parts of the building and spread quickly. Footage of the blaze was broadcast live by television crews. The government maintains that the fires were deliberately started by the Branch Davidians, but the Branch Davidian survivors maintain that the fires were accidentally or deliberately started by the FBI assault team.
Yeek.
It has been insinuated in more than one instance that some of the tear gas rounds that were fired into the building were incendiary tear gas and were not intended for use in this assault. So basically, when the task force began to run low, they asked for more tear gas grenades, and there's speculation that suggests that some of the replacement rounds were different and could have caused combustion.
Ooh. Like, ignitable tear gas.
Uh-huh.
Fook.
Only 9 people left the building during the fire.
Eef.
The remaining Branch Davidians, including the children, were either buried alive by rubble, suffocated, or shot. Many were killed by smoke or carbon monoxide inhalation and other causes as fire engulfed the building. According to the FBI, Steve Schneider, who was Koresh's top aide, shot and killed Koresh and then himself. In all, 76 people died.
That is a lot of people.
That is a lot of people. I have goosebumps.
Yep.
A large concentration of bodies, weapons, and ammunition was found in the bunker storage room. Autopsies of the dead revealed that some of the women and children found beneath a fallen concrete wall of a storage room had died of skull injuries. So this would indicate that they were actually killed prior to the collapse of said wall. The wall collapsing is not what killed them, but they died of skull injuries.
Oh.
Autopsy photographs of other children locked in what appear to be spasmic death poses are consistent with cyanide poisoning, which is one of the results produced by burning CS gas. So this could have been from the grenades, the tear gas grenades.
Mm-hmm.
The U.S. Department of Justice report indicated that only one body had traces of benzene, which is one of the components of solvent dispersed CS gas, but that the gas insertions had finished nearly 1 hour before the fire started, and that would be enough time for the solvents to dissipate from the bodies of the Branch Davidians that had inhaled the tear gas. So they're saying, like,
they got poisoned to death by the tear gas.
Yeah, or that it would have been long enough for it to dissipate and it would have had, it wouldn't have affected the fire, is what they're trying to say.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't know if that's true or not. Again, we have this, like, he said, she said kind of thing going on.
Well, and it's, when chaos is ensuing like that, you really can't specifically say for a lot of things, I'm sure.
Right, and like I said, this is happening so fast. They had been pumping in this gas for 6 hours, and then all of a sudden, three fires start at opposite ends of the building, and they're just racing towards each other and consuming this whole compound.
Ugh.
Autopsy records also indicated that at least 20 Branch Davidians were shot, including Koresh, as well as 5 children under the age of 14. Three-year-old Dalen Gent was stabbed in the chest.
Fuck.
The medical examiner who performed the autopsies believed these deaths were mercy killings by the Branch Davidians trapped in the fire with no escape. The expert retained by the U.S. Office of Special Counsel concluded that many of the gunshot wounds, quote, support self-destruction either by overt suicide, consensual execution, or suicide by proxy, or less likely, forced execution. So, they're basically concluding that these people were shot and stabbed because they were going to die in the fire anyway, and
it was a mercy kill.
A quicker death, exactly. Now, the 9 Branch Davidians who were recovered from the building maintained that the fire was not set intentionally. However, FBI surveillance had planted microphones inside the compound over the course of the investigation. Remember, they had that guy on the inside. According to them, there is recorded audio of Branch Davidians discussing what seems to be a fire starting. The recording features one man saying, "The fuel has to go all around to get started." And then another man saying, "Well, there are 2 cans here, if that's poured soon." So take from that what you will.
Oof.
Further recordings indicate that the fire had been planned from the start. FBI surveillance records a meeting starting at 7:30 a.m. between several unidentified males. I'm just going to read this kind of like a script. One man says, "They got 2 cans of Coleman fuel down there, huh?" "Empty," the other man replies. "All of it?" he asks. "Nothing left," says the other one. According to the government, a series of remarks such as, "I want a fire," "keep that fire going," and "do you think I could light this soon?" indicate that the Branch Davidians have started setting fire to the complex around 11:30.
Oh.
And remember that the fires became visible to those on the outside around noon.
So it was already burning for half an hour before they became visible.
That's what this seems to indicate. Or that they were, like, laying down fuel, preparing to light them, because they all started at the same time on opposite ends of the building. Once the fire was set, it spread very quickly. I say again here in my notes, it appeared to have started in 3 different parts of the building, all at the same time. The entire building burned to the ground in about an hour. The FBI and all attending organizations did not attempt to put out the fire at any point.
Oh.
Again, they were hoping that they would evacuate the burning building. So
that did not go as planned.
Right. And you can take from that several different things too. Like maybe they didn't start the fire, but they also didn't attempt to put it out at all.
Yeah.
And 76 people lost their lives.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, you know, oh, well, we just wanted them to come out. Okay. But you also watched them burn to death. It's really complex. And like I said, that's why, a lot of people have mixed feelings about it.
Yeah.
About 3 hours after the fire had ceased, an official searching the building confirmed that David Koresh, the leader of the Branch Davidians, was dead. I'm going to briefly discuss the aftermath of this. On August 3rd, 1993, a federal grand jury returned a superseding 10-count indictment against 12 of the surviving Branch Davidians. So the 9 who got out that last day, mm-hmm. as well as 3 who had gotten out prior.
Okay.
The grand jury charged, among other things, that the Branch Davidians had conspired to and aided and abetted in the murder of federal officers and had unlawfully possessed and used various firearms. The government dismissed the charges against one of the 12 Branch Davidians according to a plea bargain. After a jury trial lasting nearly 2 months, the jury acquitted 4 of the Branch Davidians on all charges. Additionally, the jury acquitted all of the Branch Davidians on the murder-related charges, but convicted 5 of them on lesser charges, including aiding and abetting the voluntary manslaughter of federal agents.
Mm-hmm.
8 Branch Davidians were convicted on firearms charges. Kevin A. Whitecliff was convicted of voluntary manslaughter and using a firearm during a crime. Jamie Castillo was convicted of voluntary manslaughter and using a firearm during a crime. Paul Gordon Fata was convicted of conspiracy to possess machine guns and aiding Branch Davidian leader David Koresh in possessing machine guns. Rinos Lenny Avram was a British national who was convicted of voluntary manslaughter and using a firearm during a crime. Graham Leonard Craddock, an Australian national, was convicted of possessing a grenade and using or possessing a firearm during a crime. Brad Eugene Branch, voluntary manslaughter, using a firearm during a crime. Livingston Fagan, a British national, voluntary manslaughter, using a firearm during a crime. Ruth Riddle, a Canadian national, convicted of using or carrying a weapon during a crime. Catherine Schroeder, sentenced to 3 years after pleading guilty to a reduced charge of forcibly resisting arrest. There were several other suits filed both by and against the Branch Davidians. Because remember, the Branch Davidians that got out are pissed.
Yeah,
because
they didn't attempt to put this fire out, and lots of other things, but...
In their minds, they were just a peaceful cult sitting in their compound.
Yeah. On some grenades.
Right.
Casually.
Again, they don't really see the issue with that, because they're prepared to defend their compound in case anyone should, quote, lay siege to it. Does that ring a bell from about 60 years back? And then the other thing is that some of these members that were British foreign nationals, they had, like, a bunch of other fucked up shit happen to them that I just can't get into right now, but they were being transported here and there between the different countries, and there was one man who was being tortured and interrogated about it. He was reportedly blasted at close range with a high-pressure hose and then left in his cell with an industrial fan blowing cold air at him for hours. Like I said, I just can't get into it right now, but holy fuck.
Woo.
Several people feel that the siege on the compound was and still is an example of gross overreach on the part of the U.S. government. Both the ATF and the FBI have been heavily criticized for their actions regarding the Branch Davidians. All in all, 85 people died in the resulting raid and the final siege. Among them were federal agents, Branch Davidians, and children. And as I said before, I just truly feel it's a tragedy. Like, some of these people, especially these children, were completely innocent.
This did not have to happen.
Total bystanders. This did not have to happen. Exactly. Now, do I know what the right answer is? No, I don't.
Nobody does.
It's just awful. To this day.
And,
yeah.
Like, fuck that guy that leaked the shit to the media.
Mm-hmm.
Like, damn.
Yeah. Imagine how much differently this all could have gone.
If they just left the media out of it.
They may have been able to peacefully take the compound. I don't know. Again, I can't see, you know, alternate timelines. I'm not Doctor Strange, but...
Same.
So, to this day, Waco, Texas carries with it the dark memory of this haunting tale. And that, my friends, is the story of David Koresh, the Branch Davidians, and the siege at Waco.
And it's a lot.
And we might break this episode into two pieces.
Chunks.
If not, thank you for making it all the way through that, and maybe treat yourself to a nice little snack or your favorite beverage.
But, like, maybe not an ice cream.
Maybe not an ice cream.
Yeah. That was a lot, bro, but you did real good.
Thank you. Yes, this was a lot of research to put all of the pieces together, because, like I said, you have groups on both sides saying, well, this is the way it happened. No, this is the way it happened. And, like I said, my notes were, like, 20 fucking pages long, so...
And it was impressive as fuck.
Thank you. And thank you to our listeners, as always, for listening. We love you guys. Thank you for supporting.
Like, real super whole a lot.
Like, a lot. In a good way. Not, yes. Like, a lot, like, the fucking siege at Waco.
Yeah, no, but like, that was a lot.
But, like, we love you a lot.
Word.
In a good way. And that's it for this time. We hope you keep listening. We love you. And we'll see you next time. And remember, you can check out anytime you like, but you can never leave. Bye.
Bye-bye.